Yeah, so as you can tell, this is a very generic title chosen before I knew what I was going to talk about. And in particular, the things that I'm going to talk about in the beginning, I think are the things the most interesting to this crowd, although it's kind of preliminary work that was done with a master's student, this kind of thing. And then the stuff at the end is stuff that I've been doing for a while that I know more about, but I'm not, we'll see how interesting it is to it for the very specific cases of machine learning for communications. I don't know. So in the generic introduction slide, so the first thing I'm talking about is the supervised learning problem. So everybody's familiar with this, I believe, or if not, I have a slide that will tell you everything you need to know in one slide. So you have some digits. You would like the computer to tell you what they are. You can think of a box that takes your digits and say outputs probabilities of each digit. Now there's some theta that you want to optimize to make this work well. So now, since, I don't know, I guess Jan LeCun knew it in the late 90s. The rest of us didn't know it until, you know, 2010-ish. The right thing to do is to build a multi-layer neural network. And so W1 here is the weight coefficients, and I have some pointwise nonlinearity, W2, and so on. And then the optimization is, say, stochastic gradient descent, some flavor of this. I don't know if most people are familiar with the different flavors of stochastic gradient descent, ADAM versus STD. I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because one of the experiments we have showed some significant differences there. That's the intro. So the observations of the landscape that we did for this problem, we mostly used CIFAR-10. I guess there's this attitude that MNIST is too simple to leave it as any general case. And so the solution is, of course, to go to the next more complicated thing, which is CIFAR-10. And what we looked at is we started by looking at trying to see if the shape of the minima that you find affects your generalization performance. And we were largely motivated by this work by Keskar in 2016. I don't know if people are familiar with it, but it was basically large batch versus small batch training, and they made these plots. And in the end, I think some of the ideas are valid, but one of the things we came up with mostly is that a lot of these kinds of comparisons are very problematic, and other people have seen this in papers. We'll talk about a few particular things. So one is if you have batch normalization in your network, these kind of pictures, how it's related to that. We also realized in some of our experiments why we're having strange behavior, and it was a difference between ADAM and STD. And these things really should almost be in the conclusions after the next few slides, so maybe I'll come back to them. So really, the Keskar and all that showed lots of pictures like this. So what they did is they said we're going to train a neural network using either small batch or large batch. So CIFAR-10, they started with, this is actually a plot we made. We used VGG-11. They used something very similar to this. And we used ADAM as our training. And what they did is they said they took the weights at zero, at this point zero, to be the ones trained with small batch, and the weights at one to be the ones trained with large batch, and they did a linear interpolation between them. And so this is some idea of getting some idea of what does the landscape look like between these two directions. Now, one thing that they didn't really mention in their paper, but their code was online, fortunately, is this only really makes sense at all if you start from the same initialization with these two. Right, because if I randomly pick initializations and then I switch small batch and large batch, then the space between them is very far and you get essentially nothing. So you start with the same initialization, but you use two different training algorithms for something like 100 epochs. And their point was that if you look at the test accuracy, the small batch training generalizes better. So there's the training accuracy, that's probably numerical error, they both essentially get almost to 100%. But if we look here, this is slightly higher than what we get with the large batch. And the idea was that this wide, flat minima, or not sharp minima, is going to generalize better.
So what's the alpha?
Alpha is along a single direction that connects two different minimizers. So let's be clear, neither of them are minimizers. They're the outputs of some amount of time of SGD. So I start, I pick a random starting spot, and I do mini batch SGD, or Atom. And one, I do it with small batches, and so with 256 images per mini batch, and I go for 100 epochs. Or I do it with 5,000 images per mini batch, and I also go for 100 epochs.
Sorry, I understand that. It's the interpolation.
Yes, and so then I plot the performance of these two networks along the line that connects them.
So, after convergence.
Convergence is questionable here. After I get tired of training.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, of course, my training curves have converged. My test curves look like they've converged.
Yeah, sure.
I've lowered the learning rate a few times, so I think I'm getting close to the best I can get here, I think.
So, what does alpha large alpha 1 means?
So I'm doing a linear interpolation in alpha between two completely different neural networks on the weights. And then I'm taking these networks in between, or actually it's a network whose weights is a linear combination of two different networks.
Alpha 0 and 1 are the two networks.
Yeah, alpha 0 is the network that was trained all with small batch. Alpha 1 with large batch, and alpha equal to 0.5 is some hybridization of the two.
And 1.5 is...
I just keep going. Why would it... You know, otherwise I don't get to see these nice shapes, right? If I stop it at 0 and 1, I don't get to see how smooth it is over here, mm-hmm. and so forth. Okay. So...
And 1 is the big batch or the small batch?
1 is the big batch. And so it has a sharper minima. So what would you expect from large batch training? Say I did full training. This thing, gradient descent, gets down to this really deep minima. It's very sharp because it's very low. But maybe it won't generalize well.
What does?
Well, this is another point. What's well? So this one is a few points lower than this one. And there's other papers that say large batch does generalize well. What came out of this paper was just making these kinds of plots and trying to understand what does the space look like for some actual training sets with these things. All right? So this has some problems that we're going to kind of see. So I don't know that I'm going to give you solutions. I'm going to talk about what things. So first off, this network that we use has batch normalization. And I don't know if people are familiar with batch normalization. But roughly speaking, at each layer, you say, I'm going to add to my network weights that say what the output statistics should be at a layer. So at a layer, after each layer, I'm going to normalize the output statistics to a certain mean and a certain variance. All right, that's the thing. But during training, I'm going to do something weird. I'm going to take my batch and normalize it using the empirical mean and variance. So I grab a batch of samples, I calculate empirical means and variances, and then I normalize those to my desired means and variances. When I'm done and I do testing, I actually recompute these parameters over the whole network. So it's kind of a multi-stage process. And so when people were doing this interpolation here, they were treating all the weights as the same. But some of the weights are actually these batch normalization weights, and they kind of behave a lot differently. Some of the weights are, you know, linear combination weights, and some are actually statistical estimates. And so somebody said, well, you know, it's not really fair to just interpolate a statistical estimate. So in particular, what I mean by that is, mu and sigma are outputs for a certain x. I really need to re-estimate these whenever I linear interpolate. So if I take my network and I go halfway to one in the middle, I need to re-estimate what mu and sigma is for that new network, or else I'm not even really normalizing correctly to my desired means and invariances, which have also been interpolated. And so what happens is, if you interpolate mu and sigma, you see sharp minima, like you see here. But when you actually recompute them, you get much wider minima. And I think in this curve, we've swapped 0 and 1. What it means is that a lot of these sharpness or flatness of minima seem to be very dependent on subtle details. And so I wonder... So, I mean, it would be great if we could find some characterization. You find a minima in a neural network, and you look at it from the training set, and then you say, I know it's going to generalize because it looks a certain way. I just look at it and I say, I mean, this is a little bit what Carlo talked about, right? Some local notion of local entropy, that you just see the local entropy and it says, oh, this one's going to generalize. I'm not convinced we have any good candidates for this yet.
When you say sharp, do you mean non-convex rather? Because you're using a linear path between one and the other. So the quote-unquote sharp one could just be crooked and, you know, have a more non-convex, and still have quite a lot of volume.
So this is a very good point. So volume is clearly a better measure, right, in this. And so another way to do this, right, is to pick, instead of interpolating along this direction, so I don't have two networks, I have one network and I pick random directions and I make these same plots in random directions. So we did this a little bit. And if you actually do the math for that, you'll find out this is really just giving you the Frobenius norm of the Hessian, right? Like you're just, that's when you pick random things on the outside and you find out how what the shape is, you're getting some estimate of the eigenvalues of the Hessian. And so, but maybe that's a natural notion of volume. But then so there's other work that basically says none of these are invariant under scaling, right? I just take my neural network, I rescale everything, they change widely. Is there any notion of volume that's kind of good? So I actually was searching again for this yesterday. There's a new paper out that now claims to have the right notion of volume for these things. Maybe it is possible, but this is kind of where we started in these experiments, and so it seems that subtle details matter. All right. So the other thing that we observed is we were trying to do some comparisons between ADAM and SGD, and we'd even seen papers out there that had claimed that you get wider, flatter minima from ADAM. ADAM gives these nice, wide, flat minima, and we did the experiment. They were right. That's interesting. And then we thought about it a little more, and we measured some other things. And we actually looked at the size of the weights. This is the Frobenius norm.
What do you mean by ADAM is plus minima? I mean, you did the same experiment as before with the
first stuff. But ADAM versus SGD.
Okay,
yeah, so the same.
Interpolation, ADAM seems to be...
The same batch size now, whatever, large from large.
ADAM is the one in which every time you compute these moments, I'm trying to remember which.
Oh, yeah. So, good question.
But there are two variations. So, ADAM is the one in which you compute the moments. You keep track of the first and second moments with with some exponential windows. And
so, all that really. How they compute what they do, but basically, what they're doing is they're dividing by the variance of these things. So, or the actually standard deviation.
It's an average of previous variance with an exponent.
So, if you look at a weight, and when it changes, it doesn't change your output much. So, you take one weight and it's varying and it has no effect. Well, clearly, you're not moving it enough. So, you're going to divide by that variance until some movement in that weight causes some change in the output. So, it's a rescaling that, in theory, can kind of get you the right step size for a diagonal scaling. So how do you pick a diagonal scaling that has the right step size? But it has one, everybody in this room that understands random walks has another effect, of course. It says that any dimension that doesn't matter, I'm going to start just going everywhere, right? So if I give you a variable there that's not connected to the output, you just start blowing the variance up on it. And so what we noticed is that when we used ADAM, we looked at the Frobenius norm of the weights. They just grow linearly, right? This is just all the weights that don't really matter. It's just a random walk, and these things are blowing up. So these weights get huge, okay? And you know, here we have very similar performance. This is the testing error, so the training error. I mean, between the two are fairly similar. I guess it's known that ADAM always kind of comes up a little faster in this area. This SGD is a little more gentle. But when you look here at the weights here, the range here, it's hard to see, is from 230 to 280 for the Frobenius norm. The range here is from 400 to 1600 in the same time. So there's much more weight growth. And so now when I think about it linear interpolating between the results of these two, what do I think is going to happen? What happens when you linear interpolate between a vector of norm 1 and a vector of norm 100? Right? A very small distance away, you're dominated by the 100. Right, so what it's going to mean is the guy with the bigger norm always is going to look like it has a nice wide flat minimum. Okay, and so I guess I don't show the picture where they have very different. So
it's just related to that, for the difference between the large batch and small batch training, did you do the plot of the weight norm?
We did as well. I'm not showing this. So what we found is that with SGD, We didn't have this norm growth. But with Adam, we also had this effect. So with Adam with large batch doesn't seem to have this as much. It's definitely reduced. Because think about it, Adam with large batch, you're dividing by something. It's a variance you're estimating. So like with large batches, maybe you get better estimates. And otherwise, they kind of blow up a little.
And the time of the training is renormalized by the number of updates, right?
Yeah, so...
And not the epochs.
No. So this is a tough question. So it's not really clear the right way to normalize this. So in the Keskar paper, it was normalized by epochs. But
with the same learning rates.
I think with the same learning rate. But the time was taken long enough that everything had converged. So to make it fair. Now, later papers, like after this, suggested, we need to renormalize the learning rate with the batch size. Mm-hmm. All right? But maybe to get rid of this, right, if for this one I turn up the learning rate, then the kind of stochastic interpretation of SGD means that it's kind of be the same, right? The scaling limit's the same. And so then this goes away a little bit. Mm-hmm. But in that case, I have to normalize by the number of updates, I believe, right?
Yeah. But I was also wondering, in terms of weight norm, if you just let your algorithm shoot for so many epochs, although it already reached some kind of good performance, does it just have some weights increasing because of the important dimension, or are you creating this effect?
Yeah, so I'm not sure we explored everything, but I will say that when we used Atom with small batch, the weights grew like this. But Atom with larger batch, they grew much slower.
Okay.
Maybe exactly how much I'd have to look at the plots. But
you don't know about SGD.
And SGD, they're about the same.
Okay.
Because it doesn't grow very much. So there's some difference in here, but it's all in the same range of this plot. It's not massively different. All right. So what we did, so the one thing that many of these things are things that were observed before us, is we looked, if you have a network with batch normalization, it turns out you can absorb scale factors into the batch normalization. So batch normalization each time is doing something, and it turns out if you just tweak the last layer a little bit, you can take out all the normalization. So in each layer, it could be a huge Frobenius norm, I'll normalize it to one, but I'm not going to change the output of the network. I'm just going to push that forward and push it forward. And it'll all get pushed to the last layer, if you do this right. And if instead of using like soft max at the last layer, you normalize by the sum. So you have a rectified linear unit, and you divide by the sum, then the whole thing disappears. All your scale factor goes in there, and it's gone. And so that's what we tried here. And we said that if we look at SGD and Atom with very different norms, but first we're going to normalize these networks before we do linear interpolation, right? And so what we said here, let me make sure that... before interpolation, we have on the left. So again, alpha 0 is SGD, and alpha 1 is Atom. So Atom looks very wide and flat, SGD looks a little narrower. But after we normalize the networks, they both look the same width. Now, and this is in some sense telling me that there was some problem with this whole measure, this whole picture here, because what is the thing I actually wanted to get out of this? I wanted to look at the width, and I want to predict it to the height of these test curves. That's what I really wanted to do. I want to look at the width of the blue curve and guess which one of these is going to be higher. So I still have this thing that Atom, in this case, generalizes better. But I can't really, once I normalize, I can't really distinguish much between these two. And also, people can argue these changes are small, but it's kind of hard to get a few, for these things, it's hard to get a few percentage points. So the other thing is these are all like a VGG type 11 network. If you really wanted to get these rates up higher, you can use much deeper ResNets and get maybe 5 to 8% higher in your accuracy.
And do you know if people have done any kind of similar experiments with ResNets?
I shouldn't look.
I believe that skip connections are supposed to completely change the landscape.
Yeah, so the belief is that skip connections smooth everything out. But I don't... Yeah. It's something we're trying, and I, you know, other than the fact that experiment takes 10 times longer than this experiment, we could do it. So the thing I wonder about, though, is after we did this, we liked our normalization, and we thought this is interesting, but I was left not feeling strongly about this as the right measure for generalization. So maybe that's as much as I'm presenting it now. If people know, and like I said, there's some new proposed ones that are really things that measure more volume, like that. But I feel like none of them are scale invariant. None of them are such that I can't just change my function a little bit and get totally different answers. So, yeah. I would say, in terms of open problems, finding some scale invariant measures of width of things would be super nice. But, all right. So now I'll go back to my kind of conclusions about this. So how can these observations be used? So there's a number of ensembling methods that I think are interesting. So Carl talked about entropy STD, right? So it's an ensemble training method. There's also methods that are based on like stochastic neural networks, where maybe I average the outputs of multiple neural networks, or maybe I make this as a Gaussian. And then in this case, implicitly, especially in entropy STD, you're implicitly averaging in weight space, right? If you're putting springs between three different weights, you're doing some kind of linear interpolation. And if these networks are evolving such that their scale factors are getting very different from each other, they're not going to be, your interpolations may not be good. So one thing I would approach from this is anybody who's doing entropy STD kind of stuff, do some kind of weight normalization. There's other people who have proposed various weight normalizations. We like ours, even though I can't point at it in the paper right now because my master's student has not finished that paper. the basic idea is that you can, if you modify this last slide, you can push all the weights through and get them all, have the Frobenius norm of every weight matrix be one without changing the output of your network. And so then when you're, at least it gets rid of like major differences. And the reason you might have...
Are we absorbing in the batch normalization?
Yeah, so each time you absorb in the batch normalization locally, but some part of it goes through. So like there's something that goes through that piles up at the last layer. And it has to be, I should mention this, has to be for a rectified linear unit, because I need like one homogeneous, right? I need f of a times x equals a times f of x. Which is a, so I can push scale factors through. Yeah, so I don't know if people have tried STD or something like that. And the reason you might expect it to have problems is these scale factors are essentially a random walk. Because they don't matter, they don't change the output, they're just unconstrained by gradient minimization. So they're just going to wander like a normal random walk would. There's no reason you couldn't have one weight layer in the middle just go off to infinity, the other one go small. There's no pressure on the system unless you add some L2 regularization. Now, the other thing is there's been some recent papers where people say, so I'm talking about kind of a weight normalization, or that batch normalization, the reason people came up with it and suggested it was this idea of normalizing the mean invariance of inputs to layers, and they talked about internal covariate shifts, these kind of things. But there's some recent work that says really it's just a normalization, a regularization, and you can understand it. I think this paper has a statistical physics point of view of understanding just how it's regularizing the problem, and it really has very little to do with the original motivation for coming up with it. So I think this is an interesting area to look at. Of batch normalizations does seem to really help in many cases, at least in our experiments, and it's still not really clear why. All right.
So you mean it's not regular? What was the original proposal? That it was taking care of covariance?
So everybody knows, we'll say, every statistician knows, and you know, no mathematicians know, that you should take your data and subtract it to mean zero and normalize it to variance one. Because of course this has to be better.
This is what you do in PCA.
Yeah, okay. And so they said, well, what's good in the first layer, it's probably good in the second layer, right? Shouldn't we do that in every layer? But somebody said, well, maybe it's too much to ask that it's always mean zero and variance one. Maybe it should be some particular mean, some particular variance that we learn over time. And this is what batch normalization says. It says that every layer, there's some kind of an optimum scaling of it for a particular mean and variance that you would like the data to have. And you learn that, and you rescale it. And so the idea is that when the weights change, the layers from then on are expecting a certain input distribution. So when you change the weights in the beginning, the next layer was expecting a certain input distribution. This layer in between, the batch normalization layer, will rescale to that distribution. Everything will be nicer. I'm not sure. There may have been a better motivation for it, but that's the motivation I've always heard. And and it does make things better. But so people have done experiments where they actually looked and said, when I look at these things, is that what it's really doing? They say, no, actually, it's not doing a very good job of normalizing these things, but it is making it work better. So, all right. So this is the first part. This is the thing that maybe I think fits best with the topic of this thing. But to be honest, our results on it are pretty incomplete. We're still generating a paper and this kind of stuff. So that's the preview of what we will say. In terms of the work we've been doing for a little longer, so what I've been looking at is applying machine learning to communications. And in particular, in most communications problems, we have a very well-defined method that we know works well. Like, I have the optimal detector for something, and I go to build it, and it's really big. And the guy who builds the circuits looks at me and says, I can't build a circuit that big. You need to do something to simplify it. And so one thing people do in communications is then they just do some ad hoc thing. And it works, either you lose some performance, but, you know, you can build it. And so what's come out recently is people using machine learning to find that ad hoc thing. Start with something that looks like an algorithm you know, but then optimize all the parameters to get the best performance with minimizing the complexity in some way. And so in terms of differences from traditional machine learning, so we actually, in this case, assume we have an accurate generative model. I know that when I send data through this channel, it comes out with a certain noise model. It's well modeled by my math. I also have infinite training data. I can keep generating things to send, so this is nice. Now, this is the idea so that there's no generalization error due to overfitting, but it's not clear that's true because sometimes now, depending on how I set up my network, I could have exponentially many classes. If I use an error-correcting code, and I treat each code word as a different thing, then I have so many classes that I never even see each class once. That clearly can't work. So it makes you think about these things differently. It's not overfitting, but it's like, how many samples do I need to get a feel for the distribution? Even if they're exactly the correct samples, you still need to think about that. And so instead of like a generic neural networks, we have very specific ones. So in particular, the two applications I'm going to talk about are an equalization problem for the fiber optic channel and belief propagation decoding for LDPC codes. In both cases, there's some algorithms we know, they're parameterized, and we try them out. So the classic ECE slide, the world is connected by fiber optics. That's how we all get internet here and Skype with our families back in whatever country they're in. And the way that works is you have data, it's modulated onto a laser through an optical fiber, and you receive something. And the distortion you get here is pretty well modeled by a well-known partial differential equation. There's some noise, there's not a ton of noise, but there's a lot of distortion. So the distortion is called by dispersion, so different wavelengths travel at different speeds in an optical fiber. And then there's a nonlinear effect called the Kerr effect, which is the more power is in the fiber, causes a phase rotation. Now, one of these things that's a little weird is, I'm not telling you about how this data is converted to modulation, how it's put on the fiber. The mathematical model only comes for a specific choice. So if you do a specific kind of phase modulation onto the fiber, then the next equation holds. Yeah, so then you're going to sample the output, and then you're going to do some kind of DSP to compute it. So the key constraint here is complexity. When we started this project, people were doing 10 gigabits per second. A year later, it was 40. Then it's 100. Now everybody wants 400 gigabits per second. So anything you're going to do is going to be running super, super fast. So it needs to be simple. So this is the physics model. So you have a waveform. It goes into something called the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So here, this is essentially the first part is a wave equation with some dispersion. So this is the second part is this nonlinear term that gives the Kerr effect. So the power gets modulated into the phase there. And it turns out when you want to simulate this, so somebody, the physicist gives you this model, and you're like, well, how do I simulate this from input to output? You use a method called operator splitting, which maybe people are familiar with. In my case, it sounded complicated until I had to like write it, and then it's super trivial. What do? You break it into a linear followed by a nonlinear section. So you just alternate linear and nonlinear. They're both very, very easy to solve. And so you end up with a very simple framework where to do your linear section, you take a DFT of your input, sampled input signal, you multiply by the chromatic dispersion of your fiber, you take an IDFT. So your time domain, frequency domain, time domain. The Kerr effect is a very simple update in time domain. You just take the power in the time domain and you do a phase rotation. It's a complex valued signal that you're putting in there. And then you repeat this, because each one of these things looks like a little section of fiber, like this little thing. And I'm just going to repeat it. And you do some number of steps. Now, one thing that's worth mentioning is this is the model for a fiber. The real system has fibers followed by amplifiers. And because this thing depends on the power, there's actually some significant effect to this. So when you're simulating it, you have one span, as they're called, and the power is dying very quickly in that, and then it hits an amplifier and it goes back up and dying that. So the way, when you're doing that, you have to also take that into account.
The number of steps is essentially time, right? So this is a discretization over time of...
So it's hard to distinguish between time and space here because the wave speed goes between them. Okay. So in particular, nobody ever solves for u of xt. What they actually do is they change variables in time so you follow your waveform through, right? If I want to see what's going to happen to my waveform, I don't solve the whole thing. There's mostly nothing in the fiber, but there's one wave packet, and I follow it through by changing variables. So in some sense, we don't make that clear, you're always solving it in this moving frame of reference. And in that case, because you end up discretizing something, time and space become the same kind of thing. Or there's a linear back into it. All right, so we looked at this standard solution to this problem, and we said, what does that look like? I think I've seen that before. I'm going to. So when people try and do this, it's the complexity of this is too high. People do it in simulations on computers, but no real chip does this. They just do linear equalization in real fiber optic chips these days. And one of the reasons is that the complexity seems to increase with more of these. The more of these you have, the more you need. And most people tried to take the number of layers as small as possible. That was the standard approach in the literature. But we said, based on our intuition from neural networks, let's try more layers, but make them simpler. So if we go back here, and we look at it, we don't want to do these DFTs and IDFTs, so what is this? This is a frequency domain implementation of a filter. I can just take a very short filter, say, 5-tap time domain filter, so a convolution with a 5-tap sequence. And this now, each one of these blocks becomes very simple. So we tried jointly optimized short finite impulse response filters for this. And what we noticed is that this graph was exactly the same thing as you get in TensorFlow. You have a linear section followed by a nonlinear section. And the parameters we want to optimize are actually these A's. So like we're going to fix our nonlinearity, just like you fix your nonlinearity in neural networks. And we'll just start it out with some rough approximations and see if we can find simpler, shorter filters that do well. Now, our parameters are just impulse responses for each of these things. And we're going to use standard optimization, SGD. I think we used Adam, actually, in this case. The one thing that we want to do, our whole complexity, is how short these filters are. If you start out trying to learn short filters, so this is maybe different than in every problem in COM we found. It's different than deep learning in that you can't just randomly initialize and do SGD. It never works. When you fix the graph or you fix the structure, you have a much worse landscape. And so what we had to do is we had to start out with relatively long filters that we'd optimized that we knew would work. So long filters that are almost optimal, you run it, it works great. All right, we optimize them, we're happy. And then what we would do is we would just prune the last things. We'd say, all right, let's try and learn filters one shorter. Prune the last two taps on both sides, work your way down. It's kind of a warm start initialization. And this was able to get us to reasonable performance. So maybe started with length 15 filters, and we could get them down to length 3 or 5. Yeah.
When you're talking about length of the filter, what's that space you're talking about?
So it would be, I think about it as a time domain. What's the time domain width? So it's a dispersion compensation filter. So in your fiber, different frequencies are moving at different rates. Locally, it looks like a phase shift, which depends on frequency. And what I'm going to try and do is in one unit of time, I'm going to try and undo that a little bit. And so it'd be a width in time.
Okay.
So equalization means you want to invert the original nonlinear process.
Yes.
And so why does it make sense to consider that this is such an adjoint of the forward? Why would it make sense to use the adjoint as a good surrogate for inverse? You know, you would expect this is close to being an orthogonal transform so that you can take the adjoint to be the...
It is an orthogonal transform because it's a purely complex frequency response.
It's in the linearity, right?
So this is a very good question. Like it's say a physics modeling question. So there's the real fiber. Okay, I'm going to forget about it and say I've built a model which looks like this. That is very close. Somebody says there's some limit I can get as close as I want to the real fiber.
Sure.
This thing is perfectly invertible.
Okay.
This model. Because this model, I have this phase rotation, perfectly invertible.
Yeah.
This is linear, perfectly invertible.
Gotcha.
So it's not so much that we use the adjoint, we actually use the exact inverse. And the other thing is, they're almost like, they're not quite self-inverses, but like, this is an e to the minus, you just change the sign of this. It's the same operation with a different sign. And the phase as well, you get a minus sign.
Okay.
So the two spaces are the forward and backward space is kind of symmetric. All right. So as it's an engineering talk, maybe it's a deep learning talk as well. Yeah. The theory doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the last slide, which how does it work? So not that this matters for most of the audience, we'll just say like, so there's 25 spans of 80 kilometers each. That's our physical model. We use some Gaussian RRC pulses with Gaussian modulation. 10 gigabaud. So because we're thinking of 16 QAM, which is 4 bits per thing, so this would be like 40 gigabits per second. And we're using 2 samples per symbol. That means we're oversampled by 2 in terms of Nyquist. All right? So what we have here are some results. So if you use our initialization, which is a 15 taps filter per step, you get this, it's called frequency domain sampling, so you get this black curve. If you use a little better optimized filter, which is 9 taps per step, you get this brown curve. And if you use what we call learned digital backpropagation, and we have to alternate between 3 tap and 5 tap stages, then we get this green curve with 77 taps. So if you look compared to this, you know, compared to here, maybe we're getting a factor of 3, factor of 5. And this goes directly into a power reduction. So the chip, the main complaint about these things at 400 gigabits per second is it'll melt. And so now you can have a 3 to 5 times power reduction, which is huge in this area because you're usually not getting anything like that. One thing that's maybe not fair is we found that when we optimized it, these things to get their best SNR, if you want as high SNR, are putting more power into the fiber. So this is how much power you put into the fiber, whereas we get our optimum at a little lower. So it even says it would change the system, put a little less power into the fiber and use this filter and it does better. Now, the one thing sometimes people say, well, could we get it any smaller, right? And so why do we alternate between 3 and 5 taps? Why not just go for 3 taps all the way? So the memory in the original system has some length. And alternating between 3 and 5 gives exactly the right memory. You cannot invert even the linear part with fewer taps. So if you wanted to even do no nonlinearities and invert the system, you need about 70 taps, or else it's just not possible. Because the memory in the original system is like that. So in some sense, this is the shortest one you'll ever get. The fact that you can optimize filters would have decent performance at that length is what's surprising. So how am I doing on time?
And so just to get an idea, like how far you are from the next like engineering application, like does this mean people will use it or?
Yeah, I wish. I don't know if I'm going to have. I have various slides for this thing, and I took them out. So yeah, a guy at Chalmers built the chip, and and he says he can build the whole chip with our nonlinear recovery, which works way better, for about 1.5 to 2 times the power as a linear. So if you just did a single linear filter, no nonlinear, no more, like just one linear filter, 77 taps or something, this is only about 1.5 times to 2 times the power. So we'll see. The question is, are they willing to pay 50% more power for this? Do they get big enough gains? I don't know. That remains open. But when we did it, it's like, and I actually guys from companies have contacted. I've had more people from companies contact me about this work than anything else lately.
Okay.
Like, but these guys are cutthroat. They want to be the first one, the first guy to market with something like this sells a bunch of chips, and the second guy to market doesn't. And so, it means it doesn't have to be better. It just has to be on their flyer. We use learned digital backpropagation. We sold, you know, it's. But.
So what was the improvement that it made this possible? Was it something that TensorFlow does that is?
Very good question. So this is the other talk I've given about machine learning for comm is I don't think just optimizing stuff is a good idea. I want to get some intuition. When I look at the optimum, I want to know how did this thing beat me? I think I'm pretty clever. Why couldn't I just come up with this on my own, right? And hopefully my next slide.
Well, so that's a better question I think even than I was asking. But I was just wondering like why couldn't you? Do gradient descent by hand and just code it up and then and just try this idea without the TensorFlow.
Oh, without TensorFlow. You can totally, like, I mean, people in COM were doing LMS 30 years ago. It's just painful. It's not, first of all, I didn't have GPUs and I didn't have people like give me a simple library that interfaces to GPUs. Like, this still takes a while to train.
Okay, so this is pretty.
So, like, it's okay. Conceptually everybody knew these kind of things were possible. People didn't expect it might work as well, so I didn't believe, and I also knew it would be a real pain to code all these things up and do massive amounts of training for what I thought might be a very small gain. So, yes, I do have this slide. So now this, taking it as why does this work better, what were people not doing before, this is what I'm going to try to answer. So so if we look at the filter response, if we optimize a single filter and use it over and over again, so I optimize one filter for dispersion compensation, but it's short, and because of the way it's built, I can just reuse that filter over and over again, this is what I get in my compensation. So I want this to be perfectly flat, actually, when I look at it for one filter. But when I use it 20 times, wherever there's a little bump here, it turns into a big bump. I'm taking some sequence that I want to be one, but it's like one plus or minus epsilon to a high power. And so what I find is when I design one filter, no matter what filter, I better design it really, really good if I'm going to reuse it 100 times in a row. What happens with TensorFlow is it's able to learn a whole bunch of really bad filters that when you put them together are really good. So think of it, it's almost like, we didn't try this experiment, if they had just randomly quantized different filters. They hadn't tried to learn the best filter. They said, all right, we're going to pick a filter, add a little noise, and use a different filter at each branch, such that the errors weren't correlated, then they wouldn't. Then they would have had a much slower growth in their error. And that TensorFlow goes even one better. It says, let's have the error in stage 1 and 2 be anti-correlated, so that if you're a little too big here, I'm going to try and be a little low, so I'm going to cancel out all the error on the system. Now, since this is a physics conference, I'll say, this same idea applies straightforward to any finite element method in physics. You guys make a big grid, you model clouds, and you say, I wonder how this works. You use the same block everywhere. Why? Because the physics is the same. But if you've truncated the expansion down to such a terrible accuracy that the errors are the same everywhere, you'll expect the same thing. Whatever's an error is going to be an error everywhere. And if you'd actually, say you're using a little Taylor expansion for something, if you just optimize those in a pattern, you might get much better performance for the same complexity. Does that... Does what I said make sense? That it's been a standard method. I have a repetitive system, so I'll optimize one block and copy it. But that's not the best way to do these things, because you want the errors to cancel. Whatever error you have in one block, you want it to cancel out of the next block, ideally.
hard to believe. Like, how would I know that I can cancel it? I mean, I'm not getting that. Like,
this. Oh, so in linear systems, I know you can. So this is the same idea. If many systems are like a linear component with a nonlinearity, so some kind of alternating linear nonlinear system, we know that the linear part can be canceled in a kind of a generic sense. The nonlinear part, I don't know about. Like, even this argument is only for the linear part. I can't tell you how. We did an experiment. It works well with the nonlinearity, but that's not the same. All right. So the other thing. So that project I think was successful in the sense that we liked it. This other one will almost claim this was not as successful from a machine learning point of view. I'm not going to talk that much about decoding LDPC codes. Many of you from your background in the cavity method or something know something about this, I hope. If not, I apologize. But basically, think of a Hamiltonian defined by a graph, the Tanner graph of a code. And what we're going to do is a brief propagation to try and estimate the code word that was transmitted from a noisy observation. We do the message passing. This, there might be a name for this in physics. We do everything in a log domain. So if I have binary, or if I have plus and minus one spins or binary random variables, I can just think of the log of the probability M1 divided by 0 and take this to be my a log good. So when you're doing the brief propagation equations in the log domain for LDPC codes, you get exactly this update. So when you look at the messages passed from a check node to a variable node, you sum up all your log likelihoods, and then you add your local information. So this is your local field, and this is the field from the adjacent spins. Now, Nakamani and some other guys in 2016 suggested, let's optimize this, keeping exactly the structure of original decoder, and just add these red weights. Maybe we have approximation here, like we're basically making a beta approximation on this thing, and maybe if we added some weights, we could do better. And we're assuming now that we know the true answer, so we can learn these in some machine learning fashion. So this was the work they did. We looked at it, and we were a little skeptical. We thought, maybe the weights don't have to depend on time. Maybe some kind of, we can get rid of the time dependence, so we'll try it without time. And then we actually said, and maybe you don't even need a different weight for every edge. So they used, for every spin, they had unique weights everywhere. And we get down to a model that, they had a model with maybe 50,000 parameters, and we said, we think we can do about the same with 3 parameters.
But you put back the time dependence.
Ah, there we go. I took it away again. So there's our 3 parameters. And due to historical references with other papers, this is called the RNNSS model. Recursive neural network means the weights are the same in time. Simple SS means simple scaling. It means we just made this thing as simple as possible. All right. We have different ways, loss functions. We learn cross entropy is the most natural in this case. I'm not going to talk about it. I need to show you another picture. I hope I have that. I need this picture before.
Learning 2 numbers or these 5 vectors, actually? No, I'm confused.
3 numbers.
3 numbers.
And we still use, TensorFlow because we have to compare with somebody who learns all the numbers. So we have to try the case where all the parameters are free. And then we slowly work our way down to fewer parameters.
Okay.
Now, let me just ignore the top title of this, but just look here. This is like one stage of decoding in TensorFlow. This is a signal flow diagram a la the style you get in TensorFlow. And what you're doing is you're unrolling the decoding. So people have done this before. There's this learned ISTA-LISTA, Lacoon and other guys. So in any kind of message passing or Bethe approximation in physics, you could think of unrolling that computation and then optimizing parameters of the unrolled computation.
Sorry, what is the loss function here?
So there's the math, but in words, I pick a code word I know, I transmit it, I try and decode it. My loss function is a bitwise cross entropy. I would like to get the right answer. But I know the code word I sent, I added the noise, and I just want my decoder to recover that.
You average that BP prediction over the whole trajectory.
So if I'm going to do 10 iterations, I'm going to try. What I'm going to do is multi-loss says I'm going to average over at each iteration. I try and get the correct answer. We played with all these. We now have a weighted multi-loss where you actually, in the beginning, you focus on early iterations and you slowly change it to later iterations. And all these tricks This is the thing I don't like about this research. All these tricks matter. If you don't do all the tricks, you can't train them. So it's not...
But that is the correct trick.
Even though this isn't the best trick. This slide's a little old. The best trick is weighting this and having the weights change with time. Yeah. So this is the ugly part of machine learning research. All right, so let me just, I'm going to go...
You want to do this learned BP decoding because given a specified number of iterations, there's a hope of outperforming the original BP.
Even for infinite. So yeah. BP is assuming the graph is tree-like. Okay. It's not. The correlations build up early on. Using something to cancel or weight down the correlations helps. People even do this. In fact, everybody in physics use damping, right? When you do like cavity equations, you use damping. Damping gives a huge gain in these problems. People didn't tend to use it. Even though they're like, oh, damping. But it's not until you really carefully measure how much gain it gives you. Like, wow, that's a big... For these short codes. So the other thing is when people use these methods on LDPC codes where the graph really does look like a tree, you can't help it that much. When people start using them on these like dense algebraic codes, so a BCH code is a parametric matrix. It's very dense. It's algebraically defined. It does not have low weights. It does not match the model people define BP for. That's what people are trying this. And so what we see is, let me make sure I have the right one here. So to just jump to the end, so if I actually look at the best system, so I'm using an RNN, but I'm doing fully weighted. FW means fully weighted, so I get these circles. And I compare that to the simplest one, that only three parameters, I get essentially the same performance. So we started this research when people did this, and I was skeptical. I'm like, you don't need all those parameters. We know there are ways.
The lower the better?
Good point. This is the bit error rate here versus the SNR. So yeah, so you'd like to be the lowest curve is the best.
What's the bit error?
It's the bit error rate. So it's the average number of errors in the bits after decoding divided by the block length.
And can you please explain again the color and the code of the curves?
Yeah, so let me make sure that I remember this. So I skipped ahead to give people a feel for this, so I'll start with these ones. So the black curves here, so this is a standard parity check matrix. So I just go to my textbook, I get the parity check matrix for the BCH code, I use it.
Okay.
I can do BP decoding, so that's exactly what StatFiz would tell me to do, maybe. I can do my RN and SS. I can do damping with BP. So that's BP with damping, this curve.
RN SS, that's your method.
That's, yeah, but I mean, it's our method, but it's just a simplified version of somebody else's method. And I can also, so damping with RN and all that, so there's these dots. I can also say, hey, this parity check matrix had a lot of short cycles. I want to model this thing as a cycle-free graph. I can go do linear algebra on this matrix because I can adjust the rows to each other, and I can try and get rid of the cycles. So CR here stands for cycle reduced. I've tried to get rid of the cycles in my system, and it gives a pretty big gain just doing cycle reduced, but then I can compare BP. I can do BP with damping, and actually BP with damping on the cycle reduced matrix does pretty well. This is with the... I guess we don't have the SS curve here for some reason. And then we can also add this other technique, which is called RRD, which I'll explain in a second, which is changing the graph in some way. And then this gets the best performance. And then here you have BP, or you can do our method, or you can do the fully weighted method. And so they match.
Means where you have all the parameters?
All the parameters.
S where you only have your three
parameters, yeah.
Okay, and you're saying they're the same.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the ways we came at it, so it conceptually works, but it doesn't work in the end, was I looked at this graph, and many of these codes are very symmetric. And like it was almost like this idea of symmetry. I know the code has this symmetry. If I put the symmetry on the graph, it'll move all the weights around. But if all the weights were the same, it wouldn't matter. That, like, because the code has a symmetry, you shouldn't expect all the weights not to be the same. Now, you can't quite prove this, of course, for the same reason you can't say just because a function is symmetric, its minimizer may not be symmetric. But there was some reason to believe that all these weights on an object that's very symmetric doesn't really make sense. And I'll just quickly say what our idea is. And I'm actually curious maybe to hear if this ever comes up in other physics problems. Often we have a code where the graph has a lot of symmetry. Where the code has a lot of symmetry, we could draw a new Hamiltonian that looks different but has the same, say, energy profiles. And so what RRD says is, let's do random permutations. We'll hit our problem by the automorphism group. Now, we've picked one instance of a graph to do like BP on, but we can keep changing it to symmetric problems. And this is similar to just adding a lot more constraints to your problem. And so this turns out encoding this works very well, and that's why, and in this graph what you say is, you have this thing here, and each time you're actually like permuting the thing you're decoding in a way that it remains a code word. And so that gives you this gain from the blue to the red. But maybe that, if you don't do a lot of coding, that probably doesn't make any sense, that's fine. All right, conclusions. For supervised learning, the optimization landscape is defined by the training set, but test error is what we want to minimize. How can we look at the training set and somehow decide if we're going to get good test error? I don't know. The experiments we did not seem to give us any clue about how to do that. Same question here. I think these are both very good questions. I think a lot of people are thinking about them. Then in terms of machine learning for calm, off-the-shelf packages have made it tractable now to take any algorithm we had, throw it in TensorFlow, add as many parameters we want, and optimize it. And people are doing that. I'm on some mailing list, people send these out. There's like 5 papers a day on some old comm thing, put in there, parameters, optimize, and always gets a little gain. Sometimes you know why, sometimes you don't. And then we tried it on these 2 applications. So stop there. Yes. Yeah, so think of it as you have some spin system that you know has an automorphism. If you reordered the spins, it would not change the energy levels at all. So like actually if you had like a torus, an Ising torus, right? You can rotate them around or you can do things. It doesn't change the problem at all. But maybe the actual method you're using to solve it.
Hamiltonian doesn't change if you apply it.
The Hamiltonian doesn't change.
Okay.
But maybe the method you're using to solve it doesn't have the same symmetry.
Okay.
Right? So you've picked some method that doesn't have that symmetry naturally.
Sure.
It's to essentially put that symmetry into your solver. Just try and solve your problem, do a symmetry, solve it, some iteration that interchanges these 2 operations. Add your symmetry, solve it again. I mean, in some sense, it
but
might be.
Combine the results afterwards? If you add a random rotation, you
got to track what you do.
Okay.
Maybe there's a high level, somebody mentioned this, maybe there's a high level connection between these augmented data sets. I know I shift a cat to the right one pixel, it's still a cat, right? Maybe I put that in my neural network, right? It comes in each way, or I shift it random, maybe I can do some trick like this. I don't know. But it's effectively that trick. There's some operation I know that which won't change my labels.
Yeah.
And I use it throughout my iterations. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.